Okay, I think we'll get started. Thank you for coming along to a very, what it plans to be an interesting topic with a lot of questions from the presenters for you as the audience, so keep you awake after a good lunch. So what we'll be doing is having a presentation from Sean and Andrew, and in the middle of their presentations there'll be questions and answers as well as at the end. So if I could just introduce the presenters. So we have Sean McGinn. Sean's a managing director of a boutique consulting firm, McGinn Advisory and Actuarial, based in Melbourne. He's an actuary and a fellow of the Australian Institute of Company Directors. Sean's passion is helping people. He loves using his skills, experience and insight to help people understand complexity, have increased awareness of risk, which is relevant for this section, and opportunity and improve financial and non-financial outcomes. Sean works on and for boards and their advisory committees and advises senior management of corporate and not-for-profits on financial, operational and regulatory matters and risk management. He mostly works in financial services, superannuation, wealth management, life insurance and investments, so he's well versed to cover this topic. Andrew Brown is a director at Adaptive Cultures, where he partners with clients to address their business strategies through developing effective cultural practices. He also consults to Swinburne University of Technology and lectures in actuarial practice and controls the honours year at the University of Melbourne. He's previously held senior leadership positions at AXA throughout the Asian region. So I'll ask Sean to start the presentation, and just a reminder, if you do have, or when we get to the questions part, if you can please state your name and speak clearly into the microphone for that section. Thank you.
Well, hi everyone, thanks for coming along. I suppose the first thing that people will be very aware of at this time and previous session, just before lunch, is that there's a Royal Commission in progress. And that's holding a magnifying glass, hence the magnifying glass here, to the industry. And really it's exposing quite a lot, and there's a burning in the public consciousness of some of the more extreme actions taken by people in our industry. And these are some of the biggest financial providers, and that has resulted in poor outcomes for many customers. There's a lot of people feeling scrutiny. Many of us know actuaries and others that are in the front line of that. And I think it gives us a really, you know, strong requirement to look at ourselves, each and every one of us, and look inside and feel what was our experience over the last many years and what might we have done in many of the situations that are being exposed indirectly, more so than directly. But we do have to think deeply. We do have to ask ourselves, why have these things happened? And we'll explore many of those issues as we go through today. So Andrew and I see these revelations as really being the tip of the iceberg around poor conduct and organisational culture in financial services companies. They're obviously being documented, so we won't do that here now. But shocking as they are, there are very strong patterns of behaviour through those that have been around a long time, and that's what we're going to delve into today. So we'll explore, and I'll hand over to Andrew for now. Thank you, Sean.
So let's start the session with a pop quiz. Imagine that you've been through a transformational change in an organisation. Just a very quick show of hands, anyone who has not been through a transformational change in an organisation? Okay, excellent. You're in the right room then. As a pop quiz, answer A. When you've been through, where has your organisation focused its attention? A, on structural evolution, transforming processes, systems, structures, and planning cycles that enhance ways of working and better enable the organisation's aspirations. B, social evolution. Very similar to Hayden Bernau's conversation earlier, but looking at internally within companies. Transforming communication channels and forums to enable better dialogue, respectful, challenging ideas across the organisation to leverage innovation and creativity. C, individual evolution, building deeper awareness and insight at an individual level to increase responsibility, accountability and capacity. D, combination of the two of the above, or E, all three. So very quick show of hands. Those who put A down, been through, yep. So that's about half to two-thirds of the room. Yep. B, social evolution, really focused around the relationships and the building the capacity across the organisation. One. Okay. Just hold that thought as we go through in terms of thinking about the consequences of not doing that social evolution when you think about risk culture. Yep. C, individual evolution. Anyone been in an organisation that's really focused on building the capacity of individuals? Okay. So when we think about, Anthony Ash's previous comments around that need to build a much stronger ethical lens in the people inside organisations if we're really going to respond to the things that we're facing. Yeah. D, a combination of the two above. That's good, few people. And C, all three. E, all three. Okay, about three people. Well, a couple more. Interested in people's perspectives around how successful was the cultural transformation in your organisation. So those who answered A, just focusing on structural, how successful was that in your organisation? Put your hand up, it was a highly successful transformation. Okay, those who went through B, focusing specifically around the structures, we only had one person around the social, so let's go to question C, focusing on the individual. Okay, D, those who went through a culture which focused on two out of the three, how successful was it? Just raise your hands if it was highly successful. One, great. And those who answered E, all of the above, how successful was that? Again, quick show of hands. If it was highly successful, raise your hand. None. Well, there goes the speech. That's there goes the theory. And there is more to the theory than that. Yeah? It's also how well and how effectively these are done. In the work that Sean and I do with organisations and the work I do through adaptive cultures, our starting premise is this. Unless you work on all three parts of the system, nothing will change. Right? And why is that? Culture has a way of bleeding out through the crack. Yeah? It's kind of like if I work on building better relationships between people, but I actually don't work on people's mindsets and beliefs around responsibility, I'll have a great relationship with my second line of defence, but I'll now potentially allow them to do the work, so I'll become dependent on them when I'm first line. Okay? So the unintended consequences of not working on all three parts of the system is the part that you don't work on is where culture will fail. Does that make sense to people? Yeah? Okay. When Sean and I think about culture, and this is quite a busy slide, and I'll only speak to this for a couple of secs, we look at a number of levers for change. And the levers for change, from our perspective, which are really critical, are things like leadership. And I'm not using that term on leadership of just the top three or five people in your organisation. We actually use it in a sense where it's around individual personal responsibility as a sense of leadership. Yeah? How do I self-authorise myself in the face of everything that is in front of me at work? Yeah? Risk practitioners in the room, how often do you hear people say, risk is your responsibility, not mine, or I'm too busy to focus on the risk stuff? Just very quick show of hands if you've ever heard those things in your organisation. One person. Okay, that's fantastic. Yeah? They are comments that Sean and I hear very often when we're doing work with people. Yeah? So that leadership is not just about the top people, it's about everyone. Organisational stories and beliefs. This is one which we've found to have an extraordinary effect on organisations. An organisation who will talk about the near-death experience, yeah? Who will talk about the previous CEO, and the previous CEO did not like the word program being spelt with an M-E on the end. 3 years after that CEO has left the organisation, you put up a board report which had program spelt with an M-E on the end, someone would hurriedly come down and tell you how bad that was. Yeah? Has anyone ever seen that happen in organisations? So those stories that get created get translated through, and it actually creates behaviours that aren't necessarily useful. Yeah? Organisational infrastructure, and most importantly, adaptive capacity. Yeah? How do we actually learn through whatever we're facing into and actually think about and use it as a learning lens? Really critical for culture. So how is this relevant to risk culture? The degree to which a risk culture, in our definition, is the degree to which an organisation's culture encourages or limits the taking of risks and the opportunities that arise from those risks. Yeah? Very similarly to anyone who saw Elizabeth Sheedy, we believe that risk culture is part of a broader culture. It's not separate. Yeah? But it's about how our culture enables effective risk management. Risk culture is shaped by individual evolution, social and structural, and like the three-legged stool, if one of the legs is broken, the stool will fall over. So, Sean, over to you.
So this is the karaoke part. We have to sing for our supper. Oh, even cheers. How'd you organise that, Andrew?
And it would have been good if I could feed the rock song as well.
Thanks. Oh, we could keep going. Don't encourage him. Conduct risk. How well have we served our customers? History. Looking back at history. So we've just had a lot of discussion, actually. We've had a bit of fun putting this together over the last few months. Looking back at the last 30 years, remembering some of the things around conduct that weren't good, and there's a selection of them here. I'll run through them fairly quickly, but it's just to really give you a flavour of the things that have happened, but also get you to think about, well, if you were faced with these items now, what would you do? And maybe even think again, what would you have done a month ago in comparison to now? It's quite striking, really. I mean, that's certainly what we feel personally in terms of just how a focus bring these things to mind and get you really thinking more deeply. So since those words were sung, we've had a whole lot of instances like high upfront commissions on individual risk policies sold and policyholders encouraged to surrender and re-enter. Unrealistic expectations of policyholder benefits projections, which led to actually some regulatory involvement then in getting us to do it right. Claims definition proliferations, you know, trauma in particular, all sorts of different definitions, which make it harder to compare and pity the consumer in that particular situation who is actually trying to make sense of all of this and understand if value is being provided. Policies for claims exclusions aren't transparent, so they're not obvious to policyholders. Sometimes they're not even obvious to us working in head office around these things. And then policies with the very low loss ratios. You know, there was an example given this morning by Peter Kell, the ASIC deputy. Again, where's the perception of value and is there an exploitation of the lack of knowledge of people in those particular circumstances? So that was that lot. Hopefully you're listening. And, you know, the list goes on, unfortunately. Rejecting subjective claims, the recent investigation, which 37% of TPD claims were rejected for one particular entity. Unit trust products with switching arrangements with guarantees where, in fact, the rest of the policyholder base were actually paying for those guarantees, but really there was an option against them. Companies with allegedly independent advisors that sell a significant proportion of one product are products produced by their vertically integrated model. Advising clients to transfer from defined benefit funds to defined contribution funds, taking commission, taking fees along the road, not really in the client's interest at the end of the day. And the classic one of selling products that have higher commission versus those that don't. And it's not just the person that's in the financial advisor's office really that is contributing to all of that. It's the designers of the policies, the structures around that, etc. And that's what we have to think deeply of. So over the last few months, as I say, Andrew, I've had a lot of discussion. This is probably the third draft in terms of an underlying paper that we've done. We ran out of time. We kept having too much to talk about and too much to observe. So what we've done is we've just pulled together our main observations here, and the top four here. Independence doesn't exist as we have perceived it. There's a lot of evidence that the independence of financial advisors, internal advisors, and even regulators are not as strong as we all thought they were, or maybe wanted to think they were. Some of the elements that have limited that independence are conflicts of interest, remuneration, long-standing relationships, influence through ownership, reliance on knowledge and expertise of the conflicted party. Awareness, disclosure, transparency, and alignment of interests, an alignment of incentives and the structures supporting those are absolutely essential to improving independence going forward. The second one, individual ethics are critical. Well, we've heard Anthony Asher, Andrew has mentioned this too. While a large proportion of people are likely to behave ethically, for a large proportion of the time, things get much murkier when people are facing either extreme situations or their own personal situation is at risk. It's the classic risk management thing. When the pressure and stress is on the system, things don't happen as you think they would be or as you think you would act. It's different. Daniel Kahneman, author of Thinking Fast and Slow, who's done a lot of research around behavior and financial implications from that, has concluded that people are loss averse rather than risk averse. And when that comes to your personal situation, that's what you apply. And that's in working situations. You know, if your bonus is on the line, that does take a higher level of often subconscious effect on the job that you do. To enable people to make consistently sound, decent, ethical decisions, you need a culture that supports and encourages that ethical decision making and has a zero tolerance for unethical behavior. Now that requires incredibly strong ethical role models in the organization that you're in, but it also requires a much deeper personal insight into who you are and how you work and really understand the responsibilities that you have as a person. It also should flow through in the organization across groups of people, and the structure of the organization should support it. But it starts with you as an individual taking that responsibility. And number three, structures, processes, and systems intended to drive good outcomes can actually do the opposite. Our organizations, especially the large organizations, they're multi-layered, they're incredibly complex. There are all sorts of hierarchies, both formal and informal. You get matrix management, right? That just adds another dimension of complexity. And really, when you look at it, traditional corporate structures have inherent flaws because they don't encourage the debate that one should have and that people should have around these ethical dilemmas or simply doing something proper and not straining the systems or elements of it. Compliance regimes focus attention on on compliance as opposed to the larger, wider issues around risk management and the opportunities that occurs with that, but that can be positively embarked on. But you need to take a holistic approach overall with that sort of complexity to ensure that things are clear and visible and that people can act in the right way. And number four, incentives create conflict. Unless incentives create an alignment between customers, providers and advisors, you're going to get bad things happening. And I'm not the first to say that. Conflicted remuneration incentivates the wrong behavior. As per our discussion on ethics, we haven't proven to be ethically mature over thousands of years, I suppose. What's changing now to make that change? Okay. Just a very quick one on these elements. These are not quite as important as the others in our mind, but the failure of organisations is largely due to the failure of leadership. Andrew talked about leadership earlier. It's not just from the top, although that's a key element of it. But the leaders in particular have to set and support the culture of the organisation. Unconscious biases and exploitation of known behaviour biases in finance do lead to less fair outcomes. So we've got to be aware of those things. Again, coming back to Daniel Kahneman, what's conscious, what's unconscious biases in all the decisions we make along the way. And all this leads to really our conclusion that financial services organisations need to implement a culture model as the core modus operandi and be true to that. And there is significant evidence to support that. So we might throw things open. We've got some questions here, but we're also open to anything you'd like to ask. Who'd like to comment or have a go at answering some of these here? How well have we served? Who would think more deeply now than before? Thanks, Charles.
Hi, it's Charles Hatt. A nice Kiwi song, by the way. Well, there's so much in this area, but I think the aspect that I'll focus on, which kind of goes back a little bit to what I heard you sort of asking the questions up front around structural change. I'm not really an expert on culture, I guess, but is, in a way, I have a view, I guess, that as society we've put far too much emphasis on big change, almost bang the business on this way forward, and that probably applies in the political dimension as well as the business dimension, whereas actually smaller scale evolutionary change with good feedback loops that amplify the positive things and attenuate the negative things, because there will always be some of those, is surely a better way to try and bring about change and deal with those issues quickly as they allow safe to fail things, if you like, to happen and deal with them when they do occur. So I wonder if you've got any thoughts on that.
Yeah. Thank you, Charles. Sean and I would be violently in agreement with you in terms of, if you really want to create a movement around culture change and culture transformation, it won't happen if you just focus on the very big hairy pieces without actually having the continuous small moves of what people do on every single day, which actually creates culture. Yeah, so one of our key themes is that every interaction in an organisation is a cultural intervention. Yeah. So if I actually talk to someone about a particular thing and I'm start blaming my manager, I make it okay for other people to start blaming. Yeah. So every single intervention that we have shapes the culture and the pieces that we're in. The second comment I would make is around the word change versus the word evolution and the word learning. Many organisations we work with, Sean and I deliberately use language around evolving. Yeah? So evolving says we have something that we started with, that's there for a reason. For better or worse, that's what the organisation's created. It was probably very well intended. When you use the word to change, very often people say to us, we're so glad you don't say change because we're sick and tired of being made wrong, right? And when people use that word change, it's about you're doing something to us. was when you're doing something around evolution and around learning, it's actually much more of a participatory model. Now, again, this is not participatory and it's kumbaya, we go in circles and we say everything's great. It's actually hard participatory as well, which means that when you get those constant learnings, when you and I have a disagreement, I don't make you wrong in terms of how we go about that. We look at what's the disagreement we're having and how do we collectively explore that. So it becomes more of a shared learning model and getting collective insights out. So they're just some of the thoughts that came up from your question for me, but it is very much around a model where you have continuous, ongoing evolution, if you like, can lead to much more rapid change over a shorter period of time. Yep. Any other questions that we have at this stage?
Thanks, guys. Amanda Aitken from the Actuaries Institute. I've got a question around ethics. A similar question was asked, I think, in the Royal Commission session. It might have been around, can you regulate for ethics? My question is more, how effectively can you teach ethics perhaps to someone that is often acting unethically? Can you teach them how to act more ethically, or is there not much you can do for that person?
Thanks, Amanda. So it's a really significant question, isn't it? Because we all believe at one level that we have our own ethics and our own values and we bring those into an organisation, and there's truth in that. And at the same time, how many people, when the shit really hits the fan and they're under an enormous amount of pressure, do people act as ethically as they would when everything is stable? So our view in terms of what we've observed and what works is that if I had a straight session that said to people, it's really important that you're ethical, here are the values of the company, this is what we expect you to do, this is really important to our shareholders, you're not going to get much change or shift because you're not actually getting that person inside to actually explore those dilemmas. So for me, to get mindset change, I actually, when we work with people, we'll run simulations. We'll put people in circumstances and they will do things in those simulations which we'll then explore. And we'll ask and invite people to reflect on what happened at that point when we made that decision. Yeah? How often does that start to translate into the organisation? So in terms of things like unconscious biases that Sean explored, for me, the lens that I would use is what I call developmental psychology. And developmental psychology says as human beings, we all have the capacity to broaden out our thinking. And that's not just about complex systems, it's also our ethical thinking and thinking about our consequences. So we have to get people inside to really be very close to the consequences, aware of that, and bring the consequences as immediate as possible so they can experience it. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of lenses in there, and one is that what I've described might work for a percentage of people, yeah? And what your bigger question asks is if people want to game the system, will they find ways around that? They can still turn up to the training, they can still say, oh my God, I had a life-changing experience, it's extraordinary, I realise I've been inappropriate and now I'm going to change, yeah? And to get real change at the next level requires a few pieces, and for me one of the things is actually the support around you, right? And Sean and I often use what we call the 30% rule for culture, and the 30% rule says that when you have 30% or more people who actually start acting in a new way, people will start to follow, right? So that's the important role of culture. Yeah? Will that work for everyone? No, it won't. Yeah? So you still need to have what I would call very strong accountability boundaries. And so, for example, when we're working with senior executive teams, we'll often say, every time you walk out of this office, people observe what you do. And if you behave in a way, just once out of 10 times where you're unkind or particularly aggressive with someone, guess what? That one thing will be what goes right around the organisation. So there has to be zero tolerance for acting in ways which are inappropriate. It doesn't mean that we're not that we have to be perfect, but we have to make sure we cut those pieces out. So there's how do you set the accountability boundaries in the organisation is also really critical, and how you follow through and actually enact the accountability mechanisms. Because, again, when it gets to push comes to shove, how many organisations actually follow through? Well, you know, Joe's only done it once, you know. It's not really that bad. And as soon as you allow that to happen, you create the culture which follows. Yeah. Any more questions at this stage? Yeah?
Observation rather than questions.
Yeah, go for it, Phil.
Hi, Phil Stott. I'd like to, I guess,
offer a plea to the younger actuaries who are coming through from my own experience. If you go back to the previous slide where you had number six. The second part of number six. Exploitation of known behavioural biases in finance lead to less fair outcomes. I think that's a critical one in our industry because something I've observed over the years is that there's a tendency within our industry to do that a lot because that's where a lot of the fat profits come from. I'll give you an example. I think we've got to recognise that the two things. First of all, that we're not going to be able to get away with that in the future. We could get away with it a little bit in the past, but I think that's going to be reined in. And second thing is that it's a very short-term attitude to take. And I think we as actuaries have a role to play in leading. The example I want to give is that when I was a young actuary in the 1980s, we were selling investment account regular premium policies with fairly high upfront commissions. Anyone old enough to remember those good old days? Yeah. Where basically we knew there were two facts about them which I can remember significantly. The first was that the lapse rates were roughly 10 to 15% per annum. That was measured. Everyone's assumption was around that. And the second thing was that the level of surrender penalty in the early years was such that you basically had to have a policy in force for about 5 or 6 years before the policyholder would get back the money they put into the policy. So, you know, would get any sort of positive return on the policy. Now, I remember thinking at the time that I said, well, you put those two facts together and you've got basically 30% of customers would actually get back what they put into a policy over a 6-7 year period. And Blind Freddy's going to tell you that any customer that gets back less out of an investment than they put in is going to think they've been ripped off. So we were actually selling products which were guaranteed to make 70 to 80% of our customers unhappy. Right? Now, what do unhappy customers do once they've been ripped off? Obviously, what they do is next time they go to buy a product, they don't go to your organisation. They go somewhere else. And so, you know, I was raising this issue. I'm not trying to big noise myself about this, but raising this issue in the 80s. But the general attitude that was around was, oh, well, they're told all about this up front. You know, if they're silly enough to want to terminate the policy early and pay the penalty, then they have to pay the price. And so basically the attitude was that the 70 or 80% of customers who were, you know, terminating their policies within 7 years, that they were actually being rather foolish and stupid and we had a right to profiteer at their expense. Now, what was the outcome of that? Suddenly, within 10, 15 years, we find that the life insurance companies suddenly aren't selling any investment products anymore. They've gone to unit trusts and other vehicles. Mm. And we're sitting around saying, oh, wonder why the bottom's collapsed out of our market.
Yeah.
It's amazing how these things go around. And we're seeing plenty of... There are other examples of this in insurance. Unethical behaviour. I was trapped in a lift with an organisation with a couple of executives from one of my clients who shall remain nameless, and these people worked in the general insurance side. And I just, as you talk, you know, didn't have anything to talk about while we were waiting for the people to rescue us. I just repriced my car insurance for the first time in 10 years, and
yeah.
I was amazed at how expensive your premium was. And the guy laughed and said, oh, that's because if you don't reprice it every year, then they put the premium up on you.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's just...
Yeah, thank you, Phil.
Yeah,
great. Thank you. And the only question I have is, who signed off on those products?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And that's the thing. As a profession, we're implicated in that. Whether we like it or not, we're implicated. And that's a significant question that we have to answer, yeah? So we had questions halfway through just to break the presentation up, so we still have a little bit more content. So stay gripped to your seats. One of the observations that we've had, and you've heard this today in many different settings and yesterday, is there's been a truckload of money which has been thrown at risk management in the last 30 years. And what has changed? So what has actually happened? How have we spent our money? Where have we invested it? And why are we not getting the outcomes? These are some thoughts that Sean and I have on this. And in some conversations with some of our clients, we work with a few chief risk officers, we've also incorporated some of their observations. I'm just going to tackle a couple. There are quite a few in this paper. Feel free to read after. Let's just look at the first one. Train and educate for awareness, skills, knowledge and ethical behaviour. Okay, so some organisations do that, and that's great. And so let's think through, we're looking at an organisational system, while that inherently looks like it makes sense, there are also unintended consequences. Right? One of the unintended consequences is, does it train me for the circumstances when it does hit the fan? Am I actually trained up? I could learn a lot about how to follow a risk policy. I could find all the information that needs to be there. But when I realise that something on my watch has gone wrong, yeah, and if I disclose that and I'm transparent about that, which is in the policy and what I've learned in the course is really important, that it puts my job at risk, it puts consequence around my remuneration and that kind of thing, how do I actually respond? Right? So training, unless it's focused on how you really make those hard decisions and get people inside that, won't ready people for when the situation hits. The second thing is we've heard many times people say, oh, but we've done the training now, it's okay. Yeah? So what the unintended consequence of training sometimes can be is that it actually creates complacency. A third unintended consequence is potentially we're training people for stuff that's no longer relevant. Yeah? And I can think of many, many courses I've been on like that. And I think, Mike, that'll be one of the big challenges that you will have in your role in terms of the actuarial education and how we make it continually relevant for people. Yeah. Next one, additional internal risk or compliance roles. That sounds like a great idea. Yeah. Let's stack up the second line of defence. We'll bring in some really great, capable people to support and partner with us. Positive intention is great. Symbolically, it says that the organisation cares about risk. It's putting resources behind the risk, yeah? It has greater oversight. All those things are a plus. And there are unintended consequences of a three lines of defence model, yeah? Often the first line sees that their responsibility has been outsourced to the second line, okay? So unless you actually work with the reinforcement of the responsibility of the first line, having a second line can actually mean that people will either take more risk or think less about the risk. Does that resonate with people? Yeah. Which gets to the point of don't see risk as my role. On the last one, quality versus quantity of resources. Yeah. Just having more resource doesn't mean we get better outcomes. It's what's the quality, how capable those people are doing their roles. The last one I'll tackle on this slide before we move on is risk culture assessment. So there's a lot more risk culture assessment happening. I know, I'm pretty certain that most of the large firms in Australia who have a risk practice will have a cultural assessment. My organisation certainly does. Elizabeth Sheedy shared one that she had today. There's lots and lots of them going around. But this is the challenge, yeah? What are we actually measuring? Because in the same way what gets measured gets managed, what happens to the stuff that doesn't get measured? What does the measurement actually send about what's important? It says if we're not measuring, it's not important. So unless you have a survey that has the capacity to actually measure whether people in this organisation have a genuine ethical lens, then ethics is not seen as important. Right? Second one, we only often measure outputs rather than root cause. So if you look at cultural and structural issues, it's often that the issue that's caused is not related to what's being measured on a survey. So I'll give you an example, car manufacturer in the 1990s. They released a new car, went magnificent sales. They made tens of millions of bucks in the first 6 months. After about 4 to 6 months, heaps of cars were getting recalled. They brought in a specialist. The specialist was able to identify, and the cars were getting recalled because the tyres were wearing down too rapidly. The specialist identified that the nuts on the wheels didn't fit perfectly. Okay? They went back to the part of the factory that assembled the tyres. They spoke to the senior person there, and the senior person said, I think I can explain that. Previous release, we've been asked to cut 10 grand a year out of our budget. The previous release car had some leftover nuts, and those nuts looked a perfect fit, so we used them, and we saved the company 10 grand. Just cost the company probably $50 to $100 million, though. All right? What does that tell you about culture, right? If you don't understand the consequences of using an old nut, that person's acting absolutely in their best interest, but if they don't have an understanding of the larger systems, the second, third order, fourth order consequences, bad things happen. What's that person being measured on? They're being measured on saving 10 grand. They hit their KPIs. It's fantastic. Right? I know we're all going to have stories, and I'd love to hear some other stories that people have got, but these are some of the key themes and key examples of why getting to root cause is so important and really understanding how the effect that culture has on what we do. I won't go through any more of these. I just want to focus a little bit on incentives and punishment. There was a big discussion at the last group on incentives from the floor, and I think 67% of people believe that if incentives can be created in a way, short-term incentives, that get better outcomes. I think that was right. I'd love to invite you to look at some research from a gentleman called Dan Pink. Dan Pink wrote has got a TED talk, but an RSA talk, which is an animated one, where he goes through hundreds of different research studies in about 3 minutes, which all came to the same conclusion, that short-term incentives work really well when people are doing rudimentary basic tasks. Yeah? So if I'm working in a laundry and I'm putting towels into a towel folder, which is what I did in the 1980s when I was studying at university, short-term incentives would be fantastic. You want me to go from 4,500 to 6,000 towels a night, pay me an extra 20%, and you'll see those towels fly through there. Yeah? What's the impact? Well, quality might go down from 100 to 98%, but you're really getting a much, much better outcome. You put me in a very significant role with complexity around it, and I'm getting incentives, for example, to sell children insurance policies, children insurance bank policies, right? And I'm behind on my incentive targets, and I know that I can create that in a false name, and hopefully I'll get away with that. What am I going to do? That's a much more complex situation, right? There's far more variables involved. What are the risks of me actually getting caught? How does that weigh up? Okay? So Dan Pink's research is really clear. Short-term incentives do not work when you have complex situations involved. Now, he calls it, he says, the profit motive gets unmoored from the purpose motive and bad things happen. So we focus around profit rather than around purpose. And I just think that connects into some of Anthony Ash's themes. Over to you, Sean.
So this comes back, I think, to some of the previous themes as well, and I won't spend too long on this. But just to give a bit of an impression from an actuarial perspective, as actuaries and with our actuarial skills and exams and all that we've been through, we've learned a lot. So we can do quite a lot of different things. We're not all appointed actuaries. We're not all pricing actuaries. But there are lots of variations. And in each of these, we need to remember all those basics. Firstly, as members of the Actuaries Institute, we do actually have a professional code of conduct, and there's some interesting pieces in that. Section 4.1, responsibility of members in serving the public interest. Section 4.21a, member must act with integrity, honesty, and due care, and in a manner that seeks to uphold the reputation of the profession. Section 4.4. In most circumstances, a member must exercise his or her independent professional judgment and give impartial advice. If I come back to Phil Stott's example there, the 80% losing out over time, and I saw the cases like that at the time. You know, are we doing that? Are we truly living up to our code of professional conduct? Maybe I'll ask the scary question. How many of you have read the Institute Code of Professional Conduct in the last year? Very good. I don't think I would be that good. and that's what we have to do. That's exactly what we have to do, is go back and just keep it alive. Keep it in front of us all the time. So here you've just got a couple of examples of different cases. I put in the systems and data actuary there as well, because that's the new big thing, and there's an enormous amount of work in that area. There's issues potentially of privacy, of getting data. Oh, we could get this fantastic data set if we did this, this, and this. We have to think through all the ramifications. We have to be really careful about those things so that we don't increase risks to ourselves, to our organisations and to the profession as well over time. The final one there, chief risk officer, there's quite a few actuaries that are chief risk officers, and they're right in the middle of thinking about risk culture and doing things to improve risk culture in organisations, and really trying to influence the boards and leadership to make those things happen, and the importance of putting the right systems and structures in place to support culture and giving the right example, all those things. So the challenge there to mitigate the risk is actually building strong influence with board and leadership, and they're soft skills, they're not the quantitative skills that first bring us into the profession to start with. Yeah, that's probably enough for now, so we've got some time for more questions. When you're thinking of questions, and just think about responsibility. This is all about each individual taking responsibility for their actions.
Thank you, Andrew and Sean. So, Andrew, you mentioned KPIs. Do you have any concrete examples or alternatives where we can change KPIs for, say, a sales team to avoid mis-selling, or, say, for actuaries to think beyond just commercials? Thank you.
I might answer that just at a principles level, and love any other thoughts or observations that people have got. I would say the move towards having having commissions stripped out of products and having very explicit and transparent what the cost is of the fee for advice is actually a really good first step. Right? Why is that a good first step? Because it actually makes it really clear what the cost is. I remember when I was sitting life insurance, I saw an agent just to get an experience of what that was like, and I asked that person whether they were getting a commission, and they said, no, they're on a salary, right? So straight lie, one. Two, I asked that person, well, how much of the money that I'm putting towards that policy is actually going to you? Oh, it doesn't work that way, right? Now, I'm not saying that all agents and advisors are like that. I actually believe the vast proportion of advisors are actually doing a really good job. What I'm getting to is that there's certain principles which would be you need to have transparency, you need to ensure that what you're doing is supporting that person to have anything that you do which is aligned to a good customer outcome. So some organisations might have things like an NPS, and so I'd be inviting to the question, what's the equivalent of NPS for your advice business? Sean, any comments?
No. Probably have a few minutes for a couple of extra comments or questions if people would like to make. Oh, if you can come to the microphone, or we can deliver one.
Having been in this profession for 3 decades, one of the problems that we sometimes run into with our talent is the fact that they produce numbers. And so I don't know how many times I've had somebody say, oh, it's running at a 70% loss ratio, and then they're so happy to show that they've solved this problem. And one thing I say to them, do you realize 3 people may lose their jobs if this is all we deliver in our solution? And so you start to train them as to how to, I know it isn't necessarily the actuary's job to give the script as to how to solve the problem, but I believe that our profession could provide more training around seeing themselves as the solution provider, and bearing in mind we may not get credit for the fact that we have provided a solution, and digging into people understanding how much was personal influence versus environmental influence, et cetera, et cetera. So just thoughts on how you guys would think we could help the profession advance itself to be in that light.
Thank you.
Maybe I'll start. I think the thing you've hit on there is the fact that so much comes to the soft skills of us as actuaries, and being able to influence people and influence people constructively, and a lot of that goes to the theme of what Andrew and I would look on a sound organizational culture in terms of an organization's delivery of strategy and good results. It's around collaboration. It's not me versus them or that. It is teamwork. It is sharing. It is having empathy with others. It is all of those elements that come through.
Yeah. I've forgotten what I was going to say. The role of the actuary, if you look at the brand of actuary, one of the key things that sticks out is actuaries are seen as highly ethical by our clients. So if you connect back into what Hayden Bernal was talking about today around social capital, we actually have significant social capital in terms of being trusted advisors, right, as a profession. And I actually think what you're describing is a tremendous opportunity to leverage that. And certainly for me, my encouragement is the actuaries often have a huge amount of wisdom that gets stuck, which could actually be really valuable for the organisation. That's what I'm hearing you say. And the invitation then is how you actually create the network inside the organisation to do that above and beyond what you were saying, Sean. I think that network of actually partnering with people and getting out there is really critical. And how do you do that in a way that people can receive the information and actually take responsibility for it? Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Sean and Andrew, for a very informative presentation. So please join with me in thanking them in a normal way.